Accession number 17681, Reel 1.
Colonel Robbins, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Pune, in India, in May 1918.
Was your father in the Indian Army?
No, he was in the civil service.
What, did you return to England for your education?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
I was educated in Cornwall.
Did you go to Sandhurst?
I did go to Sandhurst in 1937.
Why had you decided to go in for an army career?
I always wanted to, as a little boy. My father had been fighting in the First War, and I always thought I would be fighting again when I was grown up. And against the Germans, strangely enough.
How did you find the course at Sandhurst in the late 30s?
Well, because I went to a school that was a Methodist school and very non-military, I found it very hard. But I soon made a lot of friends there, and luckily I got into the first 15 rugger, which helped me a bit. But I wasn't very military. I was all right. I enjoyed it. It was hard for me.
Had you expected at that time a war, a new world war to break out?
It was always in the back of my mind. I did feel it, certainly, even as a boy.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Certainly did.
Under what circumstances?
I was in India, and it came over the radio there. I was in a place called Bangalore, on the, when was it, September 1939.
And what was your reaction to the news?
Well, I was very, very, very sorry that I was in India, because I wanted to be in England, and I wanted to, that's where I thought the war would be, on the continent, obviously. That's where I wanted to be. But that was not to be. And then there was the threat of the Japanese, and I certainly didn't relish the thought of fighting in Burma, where it would have been. And luckily, after Dunkirk, the army wanted as many young regular officers as they could get, and I was chosen and got back to England in 1941.
How had you gone from Sandhurst to India in the first place?
Well, I was a couple of us were commissioned into the Wiltshire Regiment, and there were two battalions in every regiment in those days. The second Wiltshires were in a place called Catterick. I went there and had six of the most miserable months of my life, because in those days the custom was that you were not spoken to by anybody. And you were treated pretty harshly. I didn't mind a lot. I was able to play rugby for the regiment, and I hunted a bit up there in the winter. But my goodness, I was glad when the adjutant, who I feel had a distaste for me, got me onto the boat, the troop ship for India. And off I went. In 1939, early.
To do what?
Off to join the 1st Battalion, who were then stationed in Bangalore, sorry.
Why was it the custom in those days not to speak to the new officers?
This seems to be a tradition in the army of those days. They were very, very rough. As a rule. Some regiments weren't. Mine was one who was middling rough. It wasn't easy.
You're talking about the senior officers?
Yeah, I'm talking about practically everyone who was senior to you. 3 or 4 years. Mind you, you obviously spoke to work. And obviously, if you were playing any sport, which was a great thing in the army, you got along a bit. But For instance, you wouldn't dare, whilst in the officers' mess, on a cold winter's day, you wouldn't dare approach the fire. And certainly, if a senior chap to you came in, you'd get up and give him your seat. You wondered in the morning at breakfast when you came into the mess whether it was safe to say good morning. Normally, you were ignored by majors and people like that. Or they'd say something rude, like, what's good about it, or don't make so much noise. It was as rude as that.
Sounds as if they were treating their juniors with contempt.
No, I think they were just brought up like that. I don't know whether it was contempt. I wouldn't go so hard as to say that. They just felt there's no need to be friendly. You were never called by your Christian name. Even among ourselves, we always used our surnames. Very interesting how the customs changed. As soon as the British Army became a national army, which it did when the war came.
So you felt that was a change for the better?
Oh, Lord. A great friend of mine and I would really have left the army. I really seriously contemplated leaving it. But when I got to the 1st Battalion in India, it seemed to be a totally different. People were much nicer for some way. They're still fairly cool, but one rode a lot and one had a nice social life, and it was much easier out there. And, of course, more work, because it was a battalion of, say, 800 men, whereas in Catterick it was a battalion of about 200 or 300. So many people were disgruntled and left the army at that time.
So, to come back to the narrative, you were telling me about returning to Europe from India, if you could pick it up from there, please.
Yes. Well, one returned at that time. We were on a troop ship, funnily enough, called the Empress of Japan. I think it was Canadian Pacific. Packed stiff with troops. It took 6 weeks to go from Bombay via Cape Town, where we stopped for a day or two, St. Helena, right out into the Atlantic, because it was a peak month for U-boat sinkings, and we actually had a torpedo fired at us, but it was a quick ship. We went within 50 miles of the American coast, came right up to the north, and landed at Glasgow, in the middle of an air raid. From there, we dispersed by troop train to wherever.
Sounds as though you probably arrived in Glasgow in the spring of 1941.
Absolutely, March, yes. And then I went straight down to London, because that's where my friends and family were. Into a new world. A blitzed world. And I was then from there one went to quickly join one's regimental depot, and from there one was posted to one of the battalions who were forming and training to go to war. I went to the 5th Wiltshires, who were stationed in Kent, places like Dover, Folkestone, Rye, Deal, waiting for the invasion, which we thought might come any minute. And we marched, big exercises, all over Kent. Very hard training. Montgomery was our corps commander at that time. A ruthless sacker of those who were not up to it, which was absolutely right. And many of those people I knew when I joined the regiment went for 6, because they just were not all right. Not good enough. And they were the ones who had failed to train us properly as young men. So a bit of resentment there.
Did you at that time still expect the Germans to invade?
We always had that in mind, certainly, and that is what we did many exercises on. And the exercises were some holding the beaches, which of course were all barbed wired and mined. And we were reminded of it daily almost, because in Dover the German big guns used to send shells over now and again. One of my platoons had a shell through the barrack room and killed 12 men. Well, the shell went over the officers' mess where we were sitting down to so-called dinner, killed these chaps. That's what we expected. We used to fire back. Also, German Messerschmitts came in an awful lot and raided all along that coast. So it kept us alert and alive. And there was the Ebert War out in the Channel. So we were very, very in it, as far as close as one could be of any troops.
So this German shell hit a barracks actually in Dover?
It hit, yes, the barracks was called Grand Shaft Barracks. And there are many instances of these large shells, which I seem to remember were almost as big as a motor car. You could time them coming over. They were so slow. But when they landed, they made rather a big bang. One of them did this to my company.
Did you visit the scene when it happened?
Yes, of course. Carnage, wrecked barrack rooms. Not funny, dead.
Which company was it that suffered most?
Well, that happened to be B Company, which I was in at that time, I think, yes.
And what approximately might the debt have been of that?
How many killed?
No, the debt. When was it?
Oh, I can't remember, but I think that was about 42. Sometime in 42. We kept moving back. Divisions or battalions were alternated between front line and then back into, say, the area of Maidstone, where another lot. So we were changed about in order to give us a break. And therefore we got to know an awful lot of Kent. So.
What then? What rank did you have at this time?
I was a captain, second in command of a company.
What happened next?
Well, we were there a long time, till 1944. And in that time, of course, one went on courses and one had a little leave. I got married, I remember, in 1940. While I was stationed in Rye. And my marriage, I remember catching the train from Dover up to London, and on that morning these Messerschmitts came over and machine gunned this train. I was lucky to reach my wedding. I had, in fact, 3 days. 3 days honeymoon.
Carry on.
The wedding was in London. My wife, therefore, had no need to be called up or anything, but she joined the Wrens and went down to Portsmouth. And, yes, I remember we had a very, very nice, expensive honeymoon for 2 or 3 days in a place called Great Egham, Surrey. Quite a well-known hotel in those days, and I think was taken over by a film company later. Very nice.
What was the attitude of the commanding officer towards his officers getting married?
Well, he didn't mind. In fact, I think I was rude enough not to have told him. He discovered by accident. But that's the way things happen in those days. I mean, there were no such things as quarters or living with your wife, you were in camp, in barracks, and you had, you had about 48 hours leave every 3 or 4 months to see your family. And then you might have 10 days leave as your leave, or a fortnight at the most.
Coming back to the attack on the train, whereabouts did the attack take place, do you
think?
It took place
just as we were passing Folkestone.
And which year might that have been?
42. April.
What damage and casualties was caused?
I don't know much. I know the roofs were ripped up and they were probably small cannon shells. But the train just steamed on. They swoop in, machine gun, and swoop out. Very quick. I remember once standing in the square in Dover, buying a newspaper from a paper boy. Gave him my half crown in those days. I waited for that. And a couple of these Germans came over, machine gunned the Dover Square. When I looked round for my newspaper man, not only had he bolted with the paper, but with my half crown, which is an impecunious subaltern I did not like. those funny little memories remain.
But as far as the train was concerned, the crew just kept it going.
Oh, yes, no good stopping. It all happened so quickly. I remember the breakfast I was having at the time. It was Ersatz's scrambled egg. I remember that. And the bullets on the restaurant car. The restaurant car.
What about the men who'd been brought into the battalion by then? Were they much different from what you had known pre-war?
In India, they were very, very different. And a great number were from where we are now in Wiltshire. And they were territorials, a lot of them. And some came from the Midlands, some from London. But it's a very strange thing that wherever they came from, those men became Wiltshiremen, Wiltshire soldiers. And that has continued to the day they died. And when you say, are they different? Of course they were different. They were straight from civilian life. Young boys, 19, 20, put straight into very, very hard training. I won't say they took to it like ducks to water, but they did it. And one wondered how they would be, these youths, when they came to face the SS and the tough, professional German army. Always one had that in the back of one's mind. Here is this victorious German army. My goodness, they're tough. And we had to toughen ourselves up. What we didn't realize, of course, was that the first troops we ever met would be three of the best Panzer SS German divisions they had. So that was something else.
Can you take me through the preparations which you made for going over to North?
Yes,
Africa?
I certainly can. We had one of the things was very, very hard training, and we got up to a pitch where you could march 100 miles with full kit in 3 days, and fight little exercises, little battles on the way. Another thing was tremendous care and training in shooting and the use of your weapons. Everyone had to be a good shot with a rifle and a Sten gun. And then there were the others who did anti-tank guns and mortars. So weapon training and shooting on the range is tremendous. A great deal of Kent became what's called field firing ranges. The farmers had to give up their land, and we did an awful lot of training with live ammunition. Many people were killed of our soldiers. Then suddenly in the 1942-3, Montgomery or somebody instituted what were called battle schools. And each division had a battle school. I happened to be chosen as one of the first instructors at our divisional battle school, which was at Deal in Kent. And my goodness, we had already gone on a very, very hard course in Barnard Castle. Brutal course. They overdid it sometimes. Little things, not little things, but like covering us with blood, throwing blood on us from slaughtered cattle. All that sort of thing didn't make sense to my commanding officer of the battle school, who was later to become my commanding officer during the fighting. So we didn't have this in our... But there was a lot of hard training. Live 25-pounder guns and exercises. Crawling under machine guns. Facing real live fire. Very, very hard training. And my goodness me, it paid off.
Did you get any new forms of weaponry?
It kept developing, but we stuck to the old 303 Lee Enfield rifle, which we all liked very much. We had the Sten gun, and I think that improved a bit. That was always a primitive weapon. The anti-tank guns became bigger, from 2-pounders to 6-pounders, and eventually to 17. The mortars, 3-inch, became 4. There was an improvement in weapons, of course. But, of course, it was the efficiency and the use of them which concerned us mostly. And always, we didn't realize this, but when it came to comparing the weaponry of the German army with the weaponry of the British, one could not conceal the fact that they were better. Their rifles were better. Their Schmeisser machine gun was so rapid compared to the Sten gun, which was not. Their pistol sidearm, the Luger pistol, much better than our 3.8 Webley or whatever it was. Their machine gun, much faster. Their 42 machine gun, I think it was, light machine gun, better than our Bren gun. They had very, very highly skilled mortars, and they had morale bombs, which made terrible noises when they came down. And, of course, the weapon which almost won the war for them, and which nearly shot our own armoured division to pieces, was the 88mm German gun, the weapon. And Honecker, of course, the only department in which we were superior was our artillery, which was massive. Germans are used to massive artillery, but by that time they were suffering from having to keep the Russian front going as well. They didn't. Well, I have experienced some really hard artillery bombardments from the Germans, and it really is shaking. Sometimes I got up out of my trench afterwards, went across to see how the men were. I saw young soldiers dead, without a wound on them. Sheer blast or fright, heart failure. Very, very common experience. So the weapons, I think, their weapons were superior.
And you knew about it at the time?
Well, we knew about German weapons because we were all the time getting information from other theatres like North Africa. But it isn't until you actually have these bullets ripping into you or these shells falling on you that you realise the difference and see the way the German panzers fought. It was quite an experience. Quite an experience.
So you were telling me about the preparations for going across to France.
Yes.
Can you continue with the narrative, please?
Well, as I say, the training was very hard. Some exercises took as long as 3 weeks non-stop, which meant living in the field, cooking in the field, marching, fighting, all weathers, didn't matter whether it was winter or summer. It almost got boring, it was so much. But what we didn't realise was how fit we were physically. That became apparent when, in an action in Normandy, one marched. We were prepared to march a long way, but in fact I don't remember marching ever more than 15 or 20 miles in action, if that. But what I did find was that when rations couldn't reach one, one could still fight and survive, not having eaten a decent meal. We could have biscuits, of course, for 2 or 3 days. And that was quite often the case. Food just couldn't get up to the front line easily. So the preparations which you asked me about were very carefully thought out. And those battalions and those troops whose commanders didn't spare them were the ones who came off best, because we learnt that training is much harder than actually being in the battle, except for the dying part.
So by the time 1944 came, were you still in with the 5th Battalion?
Yes, I was. Now what happened to me was very strange. I was rather worried about us not going into action, because I was only a young man, and a lot of my friends already had gone to Africa or joined the parachute regiment and commanders. And one of my best friends said, why don't you come and join us, the parachutes? A Wiltshire officer, but he'd gone to the... I said, yes, I will. So I put in for that. And the commanding officer of the Wiltshires didn't like this. I'm not sure he liked me anyway, but it was probably mutual. And I went. He couldn't stop me going to be interviewed, and I spent a few days. But there were 12